Iran's foreign minister sets off for South Africa to take part in a meeting of the BRICS foreign ministers in Cape Town. North Korea says it will soon put another military surveillance satellite into orbit, dismissing criticism of its satellite launch as self-contradiction. And the U.S. House of Representatives passes a bipartisan bill to suspend the government's debt ceiling and avoid a crippling default. Hello, everybody, and a very warm welcome to World News. And Iran's foreign minister has left for Cape Town in South Africa to take part in the upcoming meeting of foreign ministers of BRICS. Hossein Amir Abdullahian is scheduled to hold bilateral meetings with foreign ministers of participating countries. Prior to his departure, the top diplomat said active presence in international arenas is part of the Iranian administration's balanced foreign policy doctrine. BRICS group of nations consists of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. Amir Abdullahian said the group accounts for half of the world's population and a fifth of the global economy. It is seen as an alternative to Western economic and political influence. Iran is among more than a dozen countries seeking membership in the bloc. BRICS foreign ministers will meet in Cape Town Thursday, and then a day later they will be joined by 15 counterparts from the Friends of BRICS nations, African countries, and the Global South. They will seek to finalize the agenda for the BRICS summit in August.
In its second decade, BRICS has emerged as the world's most powerful grouping, with expanding recognition for being the locomotive of global growth. But BRICS' economic rise also marks an important geopolitical drift, as this grouping has come to be seen as an alternative to the US-led liberal world order. For instance, BRICS' collective gross domestic product has surpassed the US-led group of seven in purchasing power parity terms, while the collective GDP of the G7 shrank from 50.42% of world GDP in 1982 to 30.39% in 2022. BRICS' GDP for the same period enhanced its shares from 10.66% to 31.59%. As well, while the COVID-19 pandemic set in deceleration of the G7 economies, BRICS economies, especially those of China and India, continued to show strong potential. Also, the Ukraine war has set the stage for BRICS becoming increasingly conspicuous, as the grouping is seen as the most reliable partner for Russia. In addition, they have also not collaborated with Western economic sanctions that seek to impose obligations on other nations. Also, while the United States has been busy raising a coalition of 50 or so nations to supply Ukraine for its war efforts, South Africa, the current chair, has prioritized BRICS playing a greater role in ending the conflict between Ukraine and Russia. This clearly reflects the new bold BRICS, in face of the International Criminal Court having issued arrest warrants for Russia's president, Vladimir Putin. South Africa has announced diplomatic impunity to all officials from Russia. This confidence and enthusiasm, both within BRICS and about BRICS, makes their parlays both interesting and intriguing, with implications way beyond these five nations. For instance, about two dozen nations have expressed interest in joining the BRICS grouping. About 20 have formally applied for membership. These applicants include nations from across the world, including Algeria, Argentina, Bahrain, Bangladesh, Belarus, Egypt, Indonesia, Iran, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, Senegal, Sudan, Thailand, Venezuela, and so on. Expanding intra-BRICS trade has been the primary tool for strengthening the forum. This has lately seen increasing focus on exploring alternatives to reduce their dependence on the US dollar, and creation of a BRICS currency is expected to be on top of their agenda this week.
The South African government has in fact granted diplomatic immunity to officials attending the BRICS foreign ministers' meeting and the August summit as well. Move has been in reaction to the International Criminal Court's arrest warrant for the Russian President Vladimir Putin over the Ukraine war.
Yeah. South Africa's leading opposition party said on Tuesday it had taken legal action to force the government to arrest Russian President Vladimir Putin if he were to attend a planned summit in the country. In March, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant against Putin, who is to visit Cape Town for a Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa bloc meeting in August. On Tuesday, the Democratic Alliance Party said it launched a court application to ensure the government detains the Russian leader and hands him over to the ICC should President Putin set foot in South Africa. Meanwhile, the African National Congress Secretary General has blasted the West's pressure on his country.
Putin is a head of state. Do you think that a head of state can just be arrested anywhere? How many crimes have your country committed in Iraq? How many crimes have everyone else who's so vocal today committed in Iraq and Afghanistan? Have you arrested them?
The Kremlin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov said on Tuesday that Russia will take part in the summit at the proper level. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov also confirmed he will attend the BRICS Foreign Ministers meeting at the end of this week in Cape Town. Russian officials had previously said that Putin had been invited to attend the summit. The Democratic Alliance's legal action comes as the government granted diplomatic immunity to officials attending BRICS Foreign Ministers meeting this week and the group's Heads of State summit in August.
The U.S. has announced another military aid package for Ukraine as the West continues to pump more weapons into Kyiv despite Russian warnings. New military assistance comes as Ukraine is preparing for a counteroffensive soon. $300 million package includes munitions for air defense systems and tens of millions of rounds of artillery ammunition. It also contains anti-aircraft Stinger missiles. New package brings total sum of U.S. security assistance to $37.6 billion since the war began last year. Russia has time and again warned continued supplies will only serve to prolong the war. Earlier, we spoke to political analyst Glenn Deason about Washington's role in the war between Russia and Ukraine. He believes the U.S. is trying to actually prolong the conflict.
Biden has on several occasions, as well as the British government, suggested the goal should be to have regime change in Moscow, that Putin has to go. You have a key Republicans such as Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Dan Crenshaw, and others arguing that, you know, this is a good war for them because, you know, they have another position to, the opportunity to effectively bleed Russia. They can weaken and defeat and or weaken an adversary at least without losing any American soldiers. This is what retired U.S. General Kellogg said as well, that this should be considered a good war because, again, they can try to weaken Russia significantly without using any Americans, and then America focus on China instead. So I think that the objectives have been, while it not always been made clearly official, they've been quite obvious or open about it from day one. Even the Lloyd Austin, the defense minister, who's very openly said that the objective of the United States is to weaken Russia. So. It's not a big secret anymore what the objective is. So I think if you can prolong this war for as long as possible, keep it going, and have a forever war draining Russian resources, it would be in American interests.
For 5 months, France has been consumed by social unrest over a two-year increase in the retirement age. Many predict the coming weeks will be decisive, but few expect France's powerful president to budge. Rami Mazahiri reports.
Teachers and railroad workers led strikes nationwide in France, but the fight against the two-year pension age hike via presidential decree is heading towards what seems like a conclusion. Upset over being bypassed, Parliament is expected to hold a vote on the age increase next week, but it seems like a formality. The conservative-dominated upper house appears certain to back President Emmanuel Macron's latest executive order. Next week, we'll also see the 15th million-person march this year against the age hike, But that may be the last one. Many speculate that the hardline government has successfully ignored saucepan-banging protesters, financially exhausted striking workers, and worn down a nation in seemingly constant battle over right-wing austerity measures.
Qui sont des institutions antidémocratiques.
It's clear that Macron has all the institutions of France's Fifth Republic behind him, which are all anti-democratic institutions, and that he will not stop using them against the will of the majority and against the French people. We don't have any illusions about these institutions anymore, and something is growing in the minds of the French the more that Macron refuses to compromise, that the only thing left is a general strike to shut down the country.
The age increase was alleged to be urgent in order to plug a 10 billion euro gap in a pension system which requires 340 billion euros annually, creating controversy over a minor 3% deficit in a hugely popular social program has diverted much attention from the increasingly volatile deficit between worker salaries and record prices. Western sanctions against Russia over the almost decade-long unrest in Ukraine continue to backfire, and the strikes include wage increase demands alongside resistance to the pension age decree.
Nous, ce qu'on demande, c'est l'augmentation.
Across all sectors, there are demands for an increase in salaries, which simply can't be ignored any longer. The government hasn't increased the salaries of government workers since last summer, which seems like a lifetime ago in terms of our purchasing power.
Calls for the second general strike in the past 4 years continue to be ignored by the nation's mainstream media, as do protests by the once intensely motivating Yellow Vest group. There continues to be massive public opposition to the second pension age hike in 13 years, but unrest may peak and then start to decline next week. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Train drivers in England have started a first of three rail strikes aimed at securing an inflation-matching pay increase from the government amid the FA Cup finals and school holidays. The widespread stoppages are part of a wave of industrial action that's rocked the UK since last summer, that's despite the government's attempts to try to prevent strikes from taking place.
No work today and a fair few still to come. Thousands of train drivers from the ASLEF union have begun a two-day strike, kicking off a three-day run of industrial action across the rail network, with the strike leaving a minimum level service in some parts of the country and none at all in others.
If only they are asking for increments, I think it's fair enough, because we are working for money, so I think it's fair enough. But for the inconvenience, too, it's not going to help us too as well.
You know, when you get to the point where the government won't negotiate in a way that is, I don't know, equitable, or, you know, if they're not getting what they want, then it's, you know, when it gets to the point that you have to strike, it's pretty bad.
Trains are still running at major city hubs, but at severely reduced capacity, starting later and finishing earlier. Passengers are being advised not to travel at all if possible, and those who are making journeys to plan ahead and look at the times.
The unions say they want pay awards that match inflation, currently at 9%, and not the, quote, risible pay offer from the 16 train companies they're in dispute with. ASLEF say some of their drivers haven't had a raise in 4 years and have accused the government of wanting to destroy the railway and put it into managed decline.
It's a political decision. It's a Westminster decision. You know, we don't have this problem in Scotland. We don't have it in Wales. This is pure politics by a government that is find a resolution anyway.
The government has charged that it's at the same time insisting inflation would harm the economy. Amid strong opposition, the government has recently introduced legislation aimed at curbing unions' ability to go on strike. But that does not seem to have impacted the unions' resolve to exercise their democratic right. Said Puriza, London.
And now North Korea says it will soon put another military surveillance satellite into orbit a day after its attempt at satellite launch failed. The announcement was made in a statement by Kim Yo-jong, a sister of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. She said the North must make greater efforts to develop reconnaissance satellites given the West's fear of Pyongyang's growing access to information means. Kim emphasized that her country will take any step necessary to defend its sovereign rights. She also dismissed criticism of Wednesday's test as self-contradiction, saying the U.S. and other countries launched thousands of satellites. On Thursday, North Korea published images of what it said was a new satellite-carrying rocket lifting off from a coastal launch pad. The U.S. House of Representatives has voted to raise the government's debt limit just 5 days before a deadline to avoid a crippling default. The bipartisan bill was approved after a deeply divided House voted 314-117 to suspend the government's $31.4 trillion debt ceiling through January 1, 2025. Now the bill has to pass through the Senate before the end of the week. President Joe Biden welcomed passage of the bill, urging the Senate to pass it as quickly as possible so he could sign it into law. Biden had earlier urged lawmakers to pass the deal to take the threat off the default off the table and protect that as America's economic recovery. The bill was passed after weeks of heated debate as Republicans wanted spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. The Sudanese Army forces have launched heavy artillery attacks on bases of the paramilitary rapid support forces in Khartoum after pulling out of ceasefire talks. Now, shelling was reported in north and south of the capital. Earlier, a Sudanese government official said the country's army had suspended participation in truce talks with the RSF. Official accused the paramilitary forces of failing to observe a short-term ceasefire, which required withdrawal from hospitals and residential buildings. On Monday, the U.S. and Saudi mediators said warring parties had agreed to extend an initial week-long humanitarian truce by 5 days. Mediators have blamed both sides for violating the truce. A power struggle between the army and RSF erupted into conflict in mid-April, which has claimed hundreds of lives so far. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A year after the Zionist regime killed the Palestinian-American journalist, an FBI probe remains pending, yet the U.S. has gone silent on her death. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Intercept reported, over the last year, Abu Akleh's colleagues have continued to report on Israeli regime violence across occupied Palestine, including increasingly frequent military invasions of West Bank cities like the one she was covering the day she was killed. They have also found themselves at the center of the story, regularly updating the public about the various probes into their colleagues' death while actively participating in global calls for justice. No one has been held accountable for Abu Akleh's killing to date. Last fall, the FBI launched an investigation following a sustained public pressure campaign, including by members of Congress. That probe is ongoing, Meanwhile, the office of the U.S. Security Coordinator for the Zionist regime and the Palestinian territories, the Liaison on Security Issues in the region, has delayed issuing its own report into the killing. Along with Abu Aghele's family, Al Jazeera has filed a formal request to investigate the killing to the International Criminal Court, whose probe into an array of crimes committed in Palestine has not made much progress since it was launched in 2021. As those probes stall, many of Abu Aghele's colleagues still struggle to cope with the void she left. When Abu Aghele was shot on May 11, 2022, she was wearing a clearly marked press vest in an area with no active fighting between the Zionist regime forces and Palestinians. In the weeks following her killing, half a dozen independent reviews, including one by the United Nations, found that the Zionist regime forces were responsible. Last July, Palestinian human rights groups Al-Haq and the UK-based research agency Forensic Architecture released a detailed reconstruction of the shooting, which concluded that Abu Aghele had been deliberately targeted by the Zionist regime forces. While the killing sparked significant international condemnation, it was hardly an isolated incident. According to the UN report, last year was the deadliest for Palestinians in the West Bank since the end of the Second Intifada in early 2000s. This year is on track to be worse, as Israeli regime forces make military incursions into cities like Nablus and Jenin with increasing frequency. According to the UN, Israeli regime forces have already killed at least 94 Palestinians this year, including at least 19 children, more than double last year's number in the same period. As The Intercept reported last year, the U.S. government never investigated the Zionist regime's killing of 23-year-old peace activist Rachel Corrie, who was crushed to death with a bulldozer while protesting a home demolition in Gaza 20 years ago, nor of 78-year-old Omar Assad, a former Milwaukee grocery store owner who died of a heart attack last year while in custody of a notoriously violent Israeli regime military unit. The U.S. Justice Department's investigation into Abu Aghele's death, which came only after serious outrage at U.S. inaction in the case, marked the first time the U.S. government moved to independently probe the Zionist regime's killing of an American. As a standard with criminal investigations by the FBI, Justice Department officials have not spoken publicly about the case. The Justice Department did not respond to a request for comment. Abu Aghele was not the first journalist killed by Zionist regime forces. In a report published recently, the Committee to Protect Journalists, or CPJ, documented at least 20 instances of Israeli forces killing members of the media since 2001. Like Abu Aghele, the majority of those killed, at least 13, were clearly identified as journalists or inside vehicles with press in Sinai when they were killed, according to their report. Many more journalists were injured by Zionist regime forces, which also repeatedly targeted media headquarters. During a military assault on Gaza in 2021, for instance, the Israeli regime bombed buildings where more than a dozen local and international media outlets were headquartered, including the Associated Press and Al Jazeera. As The Intercept has previously reported, the Zionist regime also regularly detains and questions Palestinian journalists, including 16, who are currently being held without charges. To be a journalist in Palestine is a very dangerous job, said Ammar Al-Duaik, the director of the Independent Commission for Human Rights, Palestine's National Human Rights Institute, adding that journalists also face daily intimidation by Zionist settlers and troops. Al-Duaik, who was colleague of Abu Aghla, said that her killing was a reminder that nobody was safe from Israeli regime violence and that journalists were no exception. He said Shirin was visible in the broad daylight. The troops could see her wearing the vest and yet they shot her, which means that no one is safe and everyone could be a target. Being a journalist doesn't give you any protection with Israeli troops. Nor has being a clearly identifiable journalist led to greater accountability.
Food for thought.
Salam, friends. Since today is the auspicious 11th of Dhul-Qa'dah, the birthday of the Prophet's 8th infallible heir, Imam Reza, peace upon him, let us contemplate on one of his sayings, on the blessings of the presence of the divinely ordained Imam on the society. The Imam is a kind father, a helper brother, a compassionate mother to a minor child, and a refuge for servants in severe calamities.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, training kids to be confidant. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of training kids to be confidant and keep secrets in the Islamic lifestyle. It is very important that when we are raising kids, when we are training our children, and when we are raising them up, we teach them the ethics. And one of the most important ethical thing which is related to our daily life or the Islamic life is that our kids, they keep the secrets. They learn how to keep secrets. And they are confident. When we tell them something or when they know about someone, they keep those secrets. We know that in the childhood we have seen when kids are playing to each other, they keep complaining about each other, they keep telling the things that they're doing. So we need to stop kids from doing this because it will have effect on their personality. And their personality rather raising as someone who can keep the secrets, who is confident, rather it becomes someone who keeps telling everyone about the things. And, you know, sometimes we have kids who talk a lot. They have this habit of talking a lot and keep complaining about things. If we want to avoid such a thing, then obviously we need to raise them in a way that they keep the secrets. And why is it important? It is important because it is making their personality. Their personality should be in a way that they keep the secrets and they look a person who is trustworthy. So in order to be a trustworthy person, in order to be someone who is serious in his life, who takes things seriously, and he does not leak the secrets or, you know, tell the secrets of the others or maybe anything that he has said. For example, we want our kids not to be the backbiters. So the very first thing is to teach them how to keep secrets, inshallah, and the importance of this. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of raising our kids by telling them to be secretful or training our kids to be confident. Now, in order to raise them, in order to train them to be confident or to be trustworthy, it is important to talk about the importance of it. And what are the reasons that people, they leak the secrets, the people, if they are not trustworthy, what are the reasons? And if the kids, if our children know about those reasons and we have trained them well, obviously they will avoid these things in their life. And the very first thing is that people who are talkative, they cannot keep secrets. So we need to stop our kids from being someone who is talkative. And yes, I know that sometimes we want them to be talkative so that they build their it builds their confidence. But this talkative should be in a way that wherever it is necessary, they talk there. They don't fear of speaking about something. They don't fear talking with the people or socializing with the people. But if someone is too much talkative, it cannot keep the secrets because it's his habit or the person's habit is to talk, and when they talk, during talking, they leak the secrets as well. They tell everything that they know because they want to talk. On the other hand, the second thing, which is the factor that the people, they cannot be the trustworthy, is where people want to show off themselves. You know, when they want to show off themselves, they tell everything like, I know this and I know this. Why do they do this? It's because they want to show that I'm someone and they're showing off. So therefore, these two things are the initial things that we should avoid. We should train our kids in a way that they avoid to be talkative and they avoid to be someone who shows off, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Football versus enemies. Part 2.
Gaining the first international championship title for Iran was an excuse to reveal the people's emotions in a crackdown during the 1940s and 50s. That evening, people took to the streets and were festive all night long. Back then, Iran didn't have proper infrastructure, and a large part of society lived in poverty in the suburbs. Allocating funds for football to showcase the country attracted many people's attention. That trend continued as one of Pahlavi's policies. We can see the manifestations and other events like the 2,500-year celebrations of the Persian Empire. With Iran's first championship in 1946, Iran's golden decade in Asia started. Iran became the champion for three consecutive years in the Asian Cup. At club level in the same decade, Taj defeated Israel's Hapoel Tel Aviv in 1970 and won the cup. In the 1970s, Iran's league, named the Takht-e-Jamshid, Persepolis Cup, was launched. The most important event in the league was a match between Persepolis and Taj in 1973. The match ended in a historical result, Persepolis 6, Taj 0. The first important derby in the Shah Stadium, which was constructed with a hefty budget for the Blues, ended with a result against the monarchy. No video footage exists from the historical match. Some blame General Khosravani, who was the president of the Taj Club, for it. Murtaza Ahmadi, who was at the stadium and worked at the national television back then, claimed that the little footage there was at the television were ruined by General Khosravani so the monarchy would forget the bitter memory. The match was the beginning for the famous slogan by Persepolis fans. People saw they could crush big powers despite all their facilities. They could humiliate monarchy without being afraid of it, even if the wealthiest and most powerful countries support a club. Persepolis displayed the outcry of the suppressed rage of society against the royal family in the football field. Persepolis turned into a team that targeted the political goals of the monarchy. It finds fans among the people from the poor neighborhoods in Tehran and other major cities, and its opposition to Taj becomes much more important than a sports competition. Those days, Persepolis used to play unofficial matches with local teams so people would pay more attention on local teams. In one of the matches that was secretly held, Ali Parveen and his team went to the Shrine City of Qom and played against the youth team of the seminary school. During the match, Sayyid Ahmad Khomeini, Ayatollah Khomeini's son, was the defense player of the rival team. The Shah and his family were really interested in football and fervently followed it. Because of the Shah's interest, exorbitant amounts of money were spent on football. However, other sports were in pathetic condition and were not seriously supported. The monarchy always sought to keep the Shah satisfied so they would cause inequality in sports. Under those circumstances, Iran's football reached the pinnacle of success and proceeded to the World Cup in Argentina. But Iranians lacked the experience in major international events, so they failed in the World Cup. The rival team was handed 4 penalty shootouts in the first match. And in the last match, we received an own goal. No one could predict that only 6 months after the World Cup, Iran would be impregnated with major developments. When Iran was playing against other countries in Argentina on the anniversary of the June 5, 1963 demonstration, the administration of Amuzegar stepped up confrontational policies and cracked down on protests and tightened the noose around the people's necks. A few months later, the passion of the revolution spread all across the country. Amid the developments, some football players joined the people. This picture shows Mohammad Maili Kohan alongside Ali Parveen in one of the rallies in 1978. After the revolution, everything changed. The radical view against football considered it in line with westernization and Americanization, something that wastes time and an aimless entertainment whose existence at a time when there's no proper infrastructure for simple living in the country wasn't deemed necessary. Football players were confused. During the months following the revolution, as the government and hence the Football Federation weren't completely at the helm, football was on standby. Everything was changing. 1 year after the revolution in 1979, Iran participated in the Asian Games, and despite all shortcomings and objections, it was ranked among the top 4 teams. Iran had to defeat the mighty hosts Kuwait in order to reach the final. Kuwait was Iran's toughest rival back then, who hosted the games. Exactly the evening the match was being held, Saddam bombed Tehran and stoked the flames of war. The fear and stress among the players was more than ever. Iran, that was still considered the top football team in Asia after the revolution, was dragged into a long and unwanted war that gradually sucked the strength out of society, and football was not a priority anymore. Instead of Iran that was engaged in a war, Kuwait managed to take part in the World Cup twice. Thank you.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The EU Commission admitted the core inflation rate in the Eurozone, which analysts say is directly linked to sanctions against Russia, remains stubbornly high. This hits people's purchasing power, especially in lower and middle-income groups, and hurts the competitiveness of EU companies. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Press TV reported, protests in Europe are continuing unabated. Recently, thousands of teachers and healthcare professionals took to the streets in the Spanish capital, Madrid, demanding better pay and working conditions. This can be seen in other parts of Europe, like the UK and France. Britain has found itself grappling with the worst cost of living crisis in decades. Inflation is at a 41-year high, and food and energy bills have skyrocketed. In the last few months in particular, millions are struggling to cope. Throughout Europe, the ruling classes are claiming that they cannot make any concessions to the striking masses, while at the same time they are funding bank bailouts and vast military budgets to fuel the war that NATO is waging against Russia in Ukraine. According to Euronews, households across Europe are struggling to pay bills as the cost of living crisis bites and leads to street protests in many countries. It started with energy, but a cost of living crisis has now spread to all sectors and is affecting all of Europe and further afield. The problem has many components, but the one that most concerns political leaders and affects households the most is food price inflation. In February, gas prices in Europe fell to their lowest level in almost 18 months. However, food prices are continuing their upward trend. Also, Wall Street Journal, in its recent article, wrote, "It just had an energy crisis. Now Europe faces a food shock." Wall Street Journal stressed food prices continue to rise at a rapid pace, surprising central banks and pressuring debt-laden governments across Europe. Meanwhile, Bloomberg reported Brexit has weakened the UK economy and driven the nation into a sort of geriatric decline. British financier and chairman of the private equity firm Terra Firma told Bloomberg recently that since the UK left the European Union, it has been competing on the world stage, but the country's current laws are not suitable for the new environment. billionaire Guy Han suggested in the outlet's weekly Industries podcast. Unless change happens, the UK risks becoming poorer compared to other European countries. He said, "I'll look at the UK and see that in 2030, Poland will be wealthier than we are. In 2040, we will be the poor man in Europe." According to Hans, the UK should not have left the EU, as the country needs rule of law and consistency, but not a single politician is talking about going back. He lamented that Brexit has essentially thrown the country back 50 years to the 1970s, a decade that is widely remembered as the time of crisis, with a skyrocketing inflation, high unemployment, strikes, and power cuts. According to Bloomberg, the enormous amount of political change that has happened in the UK over the past 7 years has left investors concerned and the public lacking confidence, the billionaires believe. Now that the UK is out of the EU, the British government could take a radical approach and change some of its laws, Hans said, citing the country's extraordinary complex labor laws that are a nightmare compared to other European countries. The UK also needs some boring bookkeeping, and the current Prime Minister Rishi Sunak seems to be good at it, according to Hans. The financier noted that the British government has succeeded in repairing some of the damage caused by Liz Truss, whose economic policies were absolutely disastrous and would have led the country needing a bailout. Truss' argument, however, that the UK needed to become much more productive to be more competitive was 100% right.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wassalatu wassalamu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala Ahli Baytihi Tayyibin At-Tahirin. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the topic of prophethood based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. And we were discussing some of the duties of the prophets based on the first sermon and the second sermon. And we came across a few important discussions, alhamdulillah, that we covered in the previous sessions. Those who wish to look through that can refer to the previous ones online. As for the discussions that we'll have from now under the topic of prophethood, will be the discussion of the fact that the prophethood and the messengerhood of the messengers of God, however many they were, all of this, all of the messengers and the various prophets that came throughout time, all of them are connected together to form a continuum of guidance from the start of arrival of mankind till where we are today. And all of them are part of this major prophetic plan that God has kept, the plan of guidance that God has ascertained for mankind. And inshallah, we shall discuss about this in the coming section.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, we say that when we look at the various messengers and prophets, they form a continuum of prophethood, a continuum of messengerhood throughout history, throughout each point in time in history, until came the time of the final messenger, the prophet of Islam, Hadrat or Nabi Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. And he was the final messenger, the final prophet. Now, we want to discuss slightly about this issue. And when we talk about this fact that there were messengers throughout history, we don't mean to say that at every point in time there had to be the physical presence of a messenger or a prophet. What we mean to say is that whenever there was, at every point in time, necessarily there was either a prophet or a messenger or something remaining from the messenger or the prophet, a reminder, a sign, a teaching, something that would always connect the nations of people throughout time to the teachings that God wanted them to learn so as to be in the path of guidance. This is something that was necessary. Otherwise, it would negate the purpose of God creating mankind and creating human beings. There had to be that point of reference for all of mankind at different points in time so that they can connect to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the correct manner. As such, either there was a prophet, a messenger, one who was sent by God, the one who would warn people, one who would give them glad tidings. And if it was, if the physical presence of the prophet was not there, then there was something connected to the prophet, some of the effects or the results of the teachings of the prophets that were present that would continue that state of guidance. There are certain people, let's say, that were there, who we call the awsiya, who are there, who continued the path of the messengers and the prophets. And these statements that we are going to mention, inshallah, soon, of Nahjul Balagha, are showing this particular issue that I'm talking about right now.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.